I think this is recording. So my name is Sabrina. So I'm starting with a little script that I'm reading.
Go ahead.
My name is Sabrina Eager, and I am at Baker Library in Hanover, New Hampshire at Dartmouth College campus. And I'm doing a Zoom interview with Werner Trainum, who is in his home in View Heights in Los Angeles, California. Today is October 24th. October 24th, 2022, and this is an interview with Black Lives Oral History Project. Hello, Reverend Trainum. Thank you so much for joining me today. First, I'd like to learn a little bit about your childhood. Can you please state when and where you were born?
I was born in Baltimore, Maryland in 1936.
Cool. And can you tell me the names of your parents?
Hezekiah and Virginia Trainum.
Could you spell those for me?
Virginia, you can spell, I'm sure. Hezekiah is H-E-Z-E-K-I-A. I'm sorry. That's not correct. Oh. H-E-Z-E-K-I-A-H.
Got it.
Hezekiah, it's the biblical name.
Hmm.
He was the king of Judah.
King of what?
Judah.
Ah, cool.
The Bible.
And what was it like growing up in Baltimore?
Well, that is not a simple question to answer. I was born Black in Baltimore when Baltimore was part of, obviously, of Maryland, and Maryland was a segregated state. So that's the phone. That we will probably have that problem going on. I was born Black in segregated state of Maryland. I went to segregated schools. I didn't know any better. let's see, what else can I say about what it was like growing up in Maryland? I had a normal childhood. My parents were, my father was a school teacher. My mother, was a housewife. My father became a principal of a junior high school in Maryland. We were middle class Black people. I enjoyed my youth in Baltimore.
Did you go to the school that your dad was the principal and teacher at?
Oh, no.
Different district?
No. That would never have done. No, I did not. No. But my father, there were two Black communities in Baltimore, mm-hmm. one on the west side and one on the east side. We lived on the west side. One of the things that meant was that when I entered school and when I finished senior high school, all my teachers knew who my father was. So the first question I always got when I showed up for class was, "Are you Hezekiah Trainum's son?" I had, what is it? What's the phrase? It takes a village to raise a child.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all my school teachers, knew my parent, my father anyway. So the feedback loop was complete. Let's put it like that. Okay.
Was it a close community?
Happily, I was a good and enthusiastic student.
Yeah.
I don't know what my life would have been like if I hadn't been.
Did you have any siblings growing up?
No, I was an only child.
What was that like?
What was that like? Yeah. Well, I spent a lot of time with my parents, number one. And number two, I learned to entertain myself by myself. Number three, there were a number of kids in the neighborhood, not related to me, obviously, but they were my friends, and I played with them.
Okay. Would you have called it a close community, like your neighborhood, or
not? So I'm sorry?
Would you call it like a close community, your neighborhood growing up?
I wouldn't say the community was close. What I would say was people did look out for one another. If I have told this story many times. If I went up to the next block, I've lived in an apartment for the first through junior high school. A third floor apartment and a block of apartment houses. If I went up to the next block and did something I shouldn't have done, I could pretty well count on one of my neighbors getting a hold of one of my parents, probably my mother because she was at home, so that when I got home, she had already gotten the story. So I tried to behave myself. Let's put it like that.
Makes sense. So what was your high school like in Baltimore?
My high school was named for Frederick Douglass. It was a high school.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what to say about it. I had very good teachers, and I enjoyed my high school career.
Would you say, like, your high school experience had an influence on, like, you deciding to come to Dartmouth? Or how did that decision-making process happen while a high school student?
Actually, yes. that's one of my favorite stories. As I said, Maryland was a segregated state.
Yes.
There were only black students in my high school. There were only black teachers in my high school. The connection with Dartmouth is as follows. Let me back up for a moment. I met a fellow at church who went to Hamilton College. He was already obviously in Hamilton College. And I also met a fellow who was a neighbor that I had never seen before, who went to Dartmouth. Each one of them spoke up for their college. As a result, I applied to only two colleges, Hamilton College and Dartmouth College. And I wrote the essays and sent them money in and so forth. At my high school, my high school counselor told me something I was not aware of, and that was that there was a law on the books in the state of Maryland that said, remember, this is a segregated state in 1953, if there was a black student who wanted to major in a subject which was offered at the white school to which he could not go, that would have been the University of Maryland in College Park, and was not offered in the black college to which he could go, which would have been Morgan State College, the state of Maryland would pay his tuition to any school in America.
Wow.
So what I did was to get, as I said, I only applied to two colleges. Mm-hmm. What I did first was to get the catalogs from the University of Maryland and Morgan State College. I would ordinarily have majored in history. Mm-hmm. I've always been interested in history. I have a whole several bookcases of history books. But Maryland, both those schools had history majors, so that was out.
Yeah.
But then I discovered that the University of Maryland had a philosophy major, mm-hmm. but the Morgan State College did not. So when I entered Dartmouth College, I knew the state of Maryland was going to pay my tuition for 4 years at Dartmouth. And I also knew that I had no choice except to major in philosophy, because that's why they were going to pay me a tuition. At that point, I knew I was going to be an Episcopal priest. Mm-hmm. I had figured out that philosophy might just possibly be helpful in studying theology, which, as it turned out, it was. So when I entered Dartmouth College, I knew I was going to be an Episcopal priest, and I knew I was going to major in philosophy when I crossed the door sill. I could not change that. And I did. And I did very well in philosophy, if I do say so myself. I thoroughly enjoyed the major, and I enjoyed the professors in that area. Anyway, that's my connection between high school and Dartmouth College. Okay?
I can hear myself.
Can I lower the volume?
No,
oh, it's too loud.
No, I can just hear myself. Oh, it stopped. Okay, ignore me. Never mind.
Oh.
There was a weird feedback issue, but it's all good.
Actually, I can. Yeah. But I need to have some volume because I need to hear you.
You can still hear me, right?
Yes. Go ahead.
So you talked about how you already knew you wanted to be a priest going into college.
Yes.
How did you decide that? And like, what was your church community like at home before Dartmouth? And how did that decision come to be?
All right. Can I excuse myself for a minute? I need to use the restroom and I'll be right back. Okay. Okay, I'm back. You can turn the recorder back on. Where was I?
So I asked, because you said that you had decided to already be...
about the ministry. Oh, yes, right. Okay. My parents were members of the Methodist Church. My father was an AME. My mother was an ME. And I went to both those churches until junior high school. Toward the end of junior high school, I guess, one of the fellows that I played with in the street in Baltimore invited me to the Episcopal Church, which he attended. And I went to the Episcopal Church, and I really got involved in it in a way in which I hadn't been involved either in either of the Methodist churches. So I decided to be confirmed. And the confirmation class went for a year. But I learned a great deal about the Episcopal Church. And I also got to be good friends with the priest who conducted the confirmation class and was the rector of the church. I became an acolyte, and one thing led to another, and I decided I wanted to be an Episcopal priest. So that decision was made before I entered Dartmouth College. But that's how it became made.
Got it. Was it one of your closest friends that invited you to the Episcopal Church?
Actually, no, it wasn't. And as a matter of fact, he stopped going to the church. That's funny. I continued. He just, fell away. I don't know. I can't account for it. No, he wasn't one of my closest friends, as a matter of fact. He was a little older than I was. But that's what happened.
And I had a follow-up to that. What did your family think about you switching churches?
They were fine with it. They were fine with it. As a matter of fact, after I became confirmed and became an acolyte, they switched and joined my church. So, there's a passage in Scripture which says, a little child shall lead them. Well, I by my actions, not by anything I said, I encouraged my parents to follow me into the Episcopal Church. Yeah.
That's cool. And so then once you were at Dartmouth, what was that religious community like for you?
When I was at Dartmouth, what was the community like?
The religious community specifically.
The religious community. Mm-hmm. Oh, actually, the religious community was very interesting at Dartmouth. There is an Episcopal church still, as you may be aware, at Dartmouth. Father Hodder was the rector of that church. He was a small, wizened Englishman with a cracked voice. He used to come down the center aisle in the course of the service, shaking people's hands and so forth. He used to make the congregation stop if they were not singing with the kind of enthusiasm he thought they ought to sing with. He was famous for saying, "You people are singing like Episcopalians, sing like Methodists." He would invariably get them to sing much better. Anyway, there was Father Hodder had an assistant named McBurney, and McBurney was the chaplain to the students. So, and Father Harder and his wife hosted tea. This sounds odd at Dartmouth College. Remember, Dartmouth College at the time I attended was an all-male institution. Yeah. There were no women in sight in the classes and anything. Anyway, except for Winter Carnival and Green yeah. Key, which I'm sure is still the case. Anyway, I mean, you know, that women come up to Dartmouth for those two events. Anyway, so there was a group of students who met regularly with the clergy at the Episcopal Church. There was a fellow on campus named George Cobflesh. And George Cobflesh worked with the DCU, the Dartmouth Christian Union. And George Cobflesh, I've forgotten exactly what his denomination was, but he was Protestant. And George Cobflesh used to hold court in the basement of College Hall, what is now Collis Hall. Everybody, when I was a student at Dartmouth, passed through the snack bar in the basement of College Hall, because that's where you could pick up a hamburger and a Coke. Anyway, George Cobflesh held court in College Hall. He could be found in College Hall any evening. He was a bachelor, sitting there with members of the DCU talking theology. So I belonged to both these groups. And it was fascinating. DCU, I got introduced to the DCU because one of the things they used to do was to get groups of students to go out into the Upper Valley and cut wood for, you know, elderly people who needed wood for their wood-burning stoves. I don't know if anybody still has a wood-burning stove, but in the 50s, it seemed like everybody in the Upper Valley had a wood-burning stove. Anyway, but they heated their houses and that they cooked on. And that's how I got introduced to the DCU, going out chopping wood. It was a service, you know, to the Upper Valley. From there, I got involved in other aspects of the DCU. But those were the two religious, groups that I was involved with. The DCU, of course, was a part of Dartmouth College. Yes. And, of course, the Episcopal Church was a part of the Episcopal Church. Yeah.
And did those...
Huh?
I was going to say, did those ease your transition coming from, like, especially coming from, like, an all-Black high school to then a very, very white Dartmouth? Did your religion help that transition at all? Or those two communities, finding those?
I'm sorry?
Did finding those communities specifically?
I'm not sure. I adjusted very well to Dartmouth College. I have told people, which is not quite true. I have told people that the first time I ever sat in a class with white students was when I entered Dartmouth. Mm. Because before that, I went to segregated schools. Before that, I did go to segregated schools, but that was not the first time that I ever sat in a class with white students. In senior high school, I think it was probably the last year of senior high school, there was a teachers' strike in Baltimore. And the public school system decided, somebody in the superintendent decided to have integrated, to put on integrated class on television. I think it was television. Might just have been radio. I can't tell. We had televisions then. Mm-hmm. Of course, they were only black and white. Yeah. And I was selected as, I mean, this, he made up this class.
Yeah.
And I was selected to be in this class. I think there were probably two or three more black students and some white students and so forth. I don't ask me what the class was about because I don't remember, but I do remember that there was that class. That was actually the first, I mean, it didn't last very long. That was actually the first time that I was in a class with white students. But no, when I came to Dartmouth, I have always been interested in history.
Yes.
And I, despite the fact that I grew up in a segregated community and went to segregated schools, I've always regarded people as people. Mm-hmm. And one thing I knew about studying history was that white people acted just as wise and just as foolish as black people. And so when I entered Dartmouth College, it was not a problem for me. It was for, well, some of the black students that were my contemporaries. But it never was for me. I'm not quite sure how to account for that, except as a result of my study of history. It wasn't religion, really. It was history that enabled me to deal with people as people, regardless of what they were.
Yeah.
That's the answer to that question. Go ahead.
Did you end up ever, like, finding community with the other black students on campus at the time?
Oh, yes. Well, let me say this. At the time, black students, the administration at Dartmouth College put black students with black students in freshman class. I was assigned to Jean Booth. So when I arrived at Dartmouth, I was assigned to a double, and Jean Booth was my roommate. Garvey Clark was another black student. There were only four of us in our class. There were 2,700 students at Dartmouth at the time, but in my freshman class, there were only four black students. Jean Booth became the star of the basketball team. And it was the joke around the college that I was known as Jean Booth's roommate. I didn't have a name. Jean Booth had a name because he was the basketball star. Nobody knew who I was. They just knew I was Jean Booth's roommate. So that was my name. Anyway. What did you ask me? You asked me about how did black students adjust or?
Or no? I was asking if you guys had like a community amongst yourselves.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yes, we had a community amongst ourselves, a community of four. Yeah. So I had to deal with other people, obviously, because there were only four black people in my class. Now, you know, there were other black students.
Yes.
But I don't think any class had more than four black students in it at the time. Yeah.
And so what other organizations did you become really active in besides DCU?
Well, let's see. What other organizations did I become active in? I was active in the Dartmouth Players. I was not an actor. I have always been interested in the arts. Yeah. And Tony Dingman, who was a white student, obviously, got me involved in the prop room at the Dartmouth Players. I became the prop man extraordinaire. I didn't have to go out and get telephones and ashtrays and things that other prop men, the regular prop men did. I got asked first to make a oversized birdcage for the play Sabrina Thayer. And so I made it. It was about 5 feet high. Well, that got me started. I guess the pièce de résistance that I made for the Dartmouth Players was the crest for what's the Shakespeare play, parts 1 and 2? It's a historical play. What is it? Well, one of them. they're not, I think there are only 2 or 3 of Shakespeare's historical plays that are divided into 2 parts. This particular play, I forget words, you know. That's one of the prerogatives of people over 80 years old. We have the right to forget words, and I do. Henry the Fourth, I think it was. Yeah, it must have been Henry the Fourth, parts 1 and 2. Anyway, I made, you know, the crest with the, doesn't have an eagle head, lion or something other on the top. Funny thing about that crest was that it was an outside thing, and of course it hung at the back of the stage, you know. It was part of the scenery. And after the play, of course, it went to the prop room, like all the props did. And the funny thing was, maybe 3 or 4 students, one after another, came up to me and asked me if they could borrow it to decorate their room. I knew what was going to happen. And of course it happened. They would take it and they would keep it for maybe a week and it would reappear in the prop room. And then somebody else would see it and do the same thing. And the same thing would happen. It was huge. You know, I mean, it was a big thing. It was part of the scenery, you know, on the stage. And of course, you hang something like that on your wall, it takes over the room. Yeah. They had to bring it back. It was oppressive. It was just funny. Anyway, I just thought I'd mention that. But, I think, let me see, was I in any other organizations? No, I think I went to classes. I was in the 2 groups, religious groups that I mentioned, and the Dartmouth Players.
The yearbook mentions that you were in a fraternity.
Yes, of course.
Part of your life? Or?
No, Epsilon Phi. Yes, of course. Yes. But that, of course, was freshmen couldn't pledge fraternities. Mm-hmm. You had to be a sophomore, right? But I did. Yes, I at the time, again, this is 1954 now.
Yes.
There were no black fraternities on campus, number one. And the white fraternities There were two kinds of white fraternities. There were locals.
Yes.
You could join a local. There was a local called KKK.
They just changed their name this year.
Huh?
They just changed their name this year.
They finally got around to changing their name.
Finally.
Well, needless to say, that fraternity did not attract a lot of black students. It was a perfectly fine fraternity. I knew several people who were members. Never crossed my mind to join it. I joined, there were only two Jewish fraternities on campus. And of course, the Jews suffered from the same thing blacks did, namely exclusion from the fraternities. So I joined a Tau Epsilon Phi, and that was a lot of fun. I found out a lot about Jews, and I made a number of friends, of course, in the fraternity. I became one of the two vice presidents of the fraternity in my senior year. Funny stories about that too, but I won't go into that.
So it was a Jewish fraternity that you were part of?
Oh, yes. Yes, there were two Jewish fraternities on campus. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, because there were Jews on campus. They couldn't go to the white fraternities. Mm-hmm. So they set up their own fraternities. Pi Lam and Tau Epsilon Phi, I think. Yeah.
And
Pi Lam Phi, actually. Pardon?
And then what was the, like, being part of the Greek system in a very discriminatory system? What was that like? Because I know I've looked at some of the archives on the discrimination of fraternities at the time. And
one of the things that the Dartmouth Christian Union did in conjunction with some other groups on campus was to have we put an issue up to vote on campus. And that was to require the fraternities on campus that had clauses excluding Jews or blacks or whoever, had to get rid of those clauses or go local within 10 years. It was a big deal. Because, of course, it was also 1954. The Supreme Court had just struck down segregation across the country. And it passed. It was a big deal, like I said. But otherwise, we had HUMS. I don't know if they still have HUMS or not. You know what I'm talking about? You know, okay. Well, anyway, for Green Key, you still have Green Key, don't you? Okay, just checking. For Green Key, all the fraternities used to set up structure choirs. And there was a competition on Green Key. It was called the HUMS. Each fraternity would sing on the steps of Dartmouth Hall through the weekend of Green Key. And they would be judged. And, you know, somebody would, you know, win the trophy or whatever. And I participated in that. I remember singing, what was it? Something about Judd. Anyway, that was a while ago. a lifetime ago. But that was fun. And I mean, you know, the fraternities got, socially, You pretty well had to join a fraternity because there was very little social life outside the fraternities. And the fraternities tended to socialize among themselves. Yeah. There was some going back and forth, but not very much, as I recall. So, you know, for Winter Carnival, Green Key, whatever, I went to TEP, you know, and we drank beer, sang songs, did what men do in fraternities. I remember never mind. Just, go ahead.
What was the story you were about to say?
Well, I was just about to say, for one, I remember I had just said we did what men do in fraternities. And I remember on one occasion, well, let me back up. Epsilon Phi was regarded as an academic fraternity because the Jews at Tau Epsilon Phi worked very hard at doing well in school. So we were not quite as wild as some of the other fraternities as a result. But on this particular occasion, we had some kegs, and I remember beer standing that deep on the floor of the basement of Tau Epsilon Phi. That's what I was about to say. The kind of things men do in fraternity.
That's a smaller basement, though. I think that was the one all the way at the end of Frat Row, right? In that house with the pointy top?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, it was a three-story house. Yeah, with sort of a Adams kind of house. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, I guess it's still there, huh?
Yes, it's now a sorority.
It's now a sorority? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I recall that Tau Epsilon Phi is no longer on the campus, is it?
Yeah. No, we're no longer allowed to have religious affiliated frats, to my understanding.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I think.
Was regarded as a religious affiliated frat?
Oh, I'm not sure if that's why they no longer exist, but I'm unsure if, was it a Jewish fraternity or a frat that tended to have a lot of Jews in it?
Oh, that's a good question.
Because I know
it a Jewish fraternity.
Yeah.
I think it only had Jews in it. Okay. It could have had Gentiles in it, I'm sure. But the other fraternities didn't have Jews in them. I know that. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Were the other Black students in your class also in frats then? And if so, were they in your frat or did they tend to spread
out? My roommate, Jean Booth, was in Pi Lam. Mm-hmm. I don't remember about the other two at this point. I think Garvey Clark was in Pi Lam too.
And that was the other?
The fourth person, never graduated. He left Dartmouth at some point. I can't remember when.
Pi Lam was the other Jewish frat.
Pi Lam was the other Jewish fraternity. The Jewish fraternities or the local fraternities were the only options for Black people.
Yeah, interesting. Cool. What were some of your class experiences like as a philosophy major and then also other classes you took?
What were my class experiences like?
Mm-hmm. Like your courses.
Huh?
Your courses.
You mean what kind of courses did I have?
Or like what... I guess it's the types of classes, but also your experience within them.
Actually, one of my more salutary experiences was not in philosophy. My freshman year, I think it may have been the first semester of my freshman year. I'm pretty well sure it was, as a matter of fact. Royal Case Nehemiah was... had up was the well, my professor in the classics department. And I took a course freshman year with him. I, next to history, mythology was a favorite thing of mine. I figured I knew mythology backwards and forwards, Roman and Greek mythology. I, my first exam in the class, I got a C+. I expected an A. I was an A student in high school, and I knew mythology. I got a C+. So I went to see Royal Case Nehemiah, and we had a conversation. Well, one thing about Royal Case Nehemiah is he made fun of Christians. He did this quite deliberately and quite clearly from the get-go, you know. He made fun of Christians, and I remember that about him, but that didn't have anything to do with my C+ in Wetchikon. But he explained to me why I got a C+. And I said, all right, I'm not going to get a C+ in this class. And I didn't. I got a B+. The reason I didn't get an A+ is because in my first exam, I got a C+. So there was no possibility of getting an A+. But I did get a B+. And that taught me that Dartmouth College was going to be a different game from Douglas High School. Mm-hmm. There was another, I took a course, Government One, with a little guy, short guy. I can't think of his name at the moment. But anyway, I remember this very distinctly. And that was probably the second semester of my freshman year. Sneed or Smeed, or something like that was his name. Of course, I'm sure he's long gone. But anyway, he pointed me out after an exam. I got an A+ in that class. He pointed me out at the end of the exam he said, you know, the rest of the students should look at Mr. Trainham, because Mr. Trainham has read the footnotes in this book on Government One. He had to have read the footnotes because he couldn't have answered questions such and such, such and such and such and such if he hadn't. And the reason he was right, the reason I had read the footnotes was because of my conversation with Royal Case Nehemiah. I was going to play this game, and I was going to win it. I graduated from Dartmouth with honors in philosophy and a magna cum laude. The reason I did was because of Royal Case Nehemiah. That was the smartest course I ever took, because, like I said, he made it clear to me that I was not going to cruise through this school. Yeah. And I didn't. I read the footnotes whenever there was footnotes in a book or whatever, you know? So when I went into the exam, I knew everything it was possible for me to know, having taken that class in that exam. So I tried to minimize the surprises. What else can I say about classes at Dartmouth? Like I said, I enjoyed my Dartmouth experience across the board, really. I ran into, at least I cannot remember any racist problems. I may have just, you know, suppressed them over a half a century. I've had plenty of time to forget them if they were. My experiences were really quite positive. I enjoyed them, like I said. Even Royal Case Nehemiah's, like I said, you know, I profited from that. You know, it was a shock.
Yeah.
It was a shock, but a good shock, you know?
I had a similar freshman fall class. It was
the best way to begin my freshman year, that's right. As it turned out, I didn't think so at the moment.
Yeah.
Needless to say, but, you know. Anyway.
You mentioned that you graduated with honors. Did you write a thesis then?
No. Okay. No, we didn't have to write theses then. No. In philosophy, no.
Did you do any like outside coursework related to philosophy or religion or history, any of those areas, or was it mostly just your classes?
No. I did papers. I did a paper on Albert Schweitzer for T.S.K. Scott Craig, who was an Episcopalian. He went to St. Thomas Church. One of the few faculty members that ever darkened the door of any church, I think. Having said that, this is apropos of nothing in particular, but I remember my surprise when I first came to Dartmouth and people started talking about the white church. The white church was painted white. That's why it was called the white church. It was not a white church because only white people went there, like the fraternities. But it was a surprise for a black person to hear about the white church at Dartmouth College, in Hanover. What else can I say about classes? No, I got along fairly well with people. Because I had a reputation for being a good student, I had people, you know, who asked me to help them with various classes and so forth, and I did. I was very happy to do that. It was known by all the people that I knew that I was going to be an Episcopal priest. I had a friend named Schreibman, who was in my fraternity. Again, a short guy, who was going to be a rabbi. And so we both got, you know, cornered by people from time to time to discuss religious questions or ethical questions or whatever.
Yeah, cool. So then after
my Dartmouth experience was very positive.
Yeah,
I, you know, I can't account for that fact, but it was. Because I know some black students whose experiences were not positive. Anyway.
How did the isolation of campus, did that affect you at all?
The isolation of campus? Actually, no, I must say, one of the jobs I had after, you know, I began my work life was at Harvard. I was the associate Episcopal chaplain at Harvard. And at Harvard was the first time I ever went skiing. I think it's funny because, of course, I went to Dartmouth College. And, you know, most people who go ski at Dartmouth College.
Yeah.
I never skied at Dartmouth College. I concluded after my college career that, you know, when you go to Dartmouth, you are wise to learn how to use the winter since there's so much of it. Yeah. There was more winter then when I was going to school than there is now, because now you can take off the winter term if you want to. But that was not an option. The only term you took off was the summer vacation, you know, and that was, of course, in the summer. That's the best time to be at Dartmouth. We were never there. I mean, that's from my perspective. Obviously, if you like to ski, and so winter's the best time, right? What was I getting ready to say? Oh, I learned to study in the winter. So I went to Baker Library or to the Tower Room, you know. I guess, yeah, the Baker Library is still there, so the Tower Room must still be there. Or where the paintings are.
The Orozco Room.
The Orozco, yeah. The study room downstairs. In the basement. That's what I did for the winter. You know, the winter was a good thing for me because I stayed inside and I studied.
Yeah.
But I never went skiing. For winter carnival, you know, we built the center of campus snow statues.
Mm-hmm.
And of course each fraternity had a snow statue then. Mm-hmm. I don't know. They don't do that now?
You can sign up with your club to do an ice sculpture now.
Yeah.
But I don't know any Greek houses that do that. I think they're
When I was there, that's what the Greek houses did. They did the Hums I've already explained the Hums. Yeah. The Hums at Green Key, and they built ice statues in front of their houses. And that was a competition too. Mm. And of course the freshmen were the big builders of the center campus statue and the bonfires. They still do the bonfires, I'm sure.
Yeah, they're building it right now. It's next week.
Everybody loves bonfires. Yeah, they'll never give up bonfires.
They almost did. Nice thing about,
huh?
They almost did.
The fire department, really?
Yeah, but they just changed the shape of it, and now it's okay.
Change the shape, and now it's okay?
It's harder to collapse now, so it's safer.
Oh, I see. Oh, yeah, well, I guess, yeah, if it collapses, the sparks would go everywhere. Yeah. Yeah. I don't remember us having that problem. But anyway, there was something else I was getting ready to say.
Winter carnival.
That kind of thing. I can't remember. Well, next question.
I can transition to your post-Dartmouth life a little now. So you left Dartmouth already knowing you wanted to be an Episcopal priest. What was the transition then to becoming one after Dartmouth? And how did Dartmouth affect that?
Well, when I graduated from Dartmouth, I had gotten a Reynolds Scholarship. From Dartmouth. So I went for a year. I was for a year recognized student at Oxford. Oh. If I had realized that I could have renewed my Reynolds Scholarship, I would probably have taken a degree at Oxford because I could have done that in 2 years, but not in one. So anyway, I went to Oxford as a recognized student for 1 year. Dr. F.L. Cross was my tutor. He wrote the Dictionary of the Christian Church. He was an extremely reticent, shy man who spent his life organizing conferences, the kind of thing you would expect an extrovert to do.
Yeah.
He was clearly an introvert, but he was a church history scholar. Excuse me. He was in church history. So I went to Dartmouth. F.L. Cross was at the house, which is the, getting words again. it's the biggest college at Oxford. It was built by Cardinal Wolsey, and he incorporated the Cathedral Church of Oxford into his college. So the Cathedral Church of Oxford is the chapel of the college. F.L. Cross suggested to me that I should come a little early because there was to be a conference on the Gospels at Oxford. He was organizing it. And so I went early, and they put me up in University College, which is where Shelley statue lies, and where Shelley, the poet Shelley, attended. I had two large rooms. This is in the fall. I had two large rooms. The living room was probably twice as large as the bedroom, and the bedroom was not small. To heat those two rooms, I had a little electric heater with a single coil. That was a salutary introduction to Oxford, because when I stayed in those rooms just before the university opened, I almost froze to death, because it was colder in my rooms than it was outside in the street. And to heat those two rooms, it was stone. You know, all the buildings in Oxford are stone. You know? There is no central heating. Yeah. They don't believe in central heating. So when I left university to attend the college, Christ Church was the college, I looked for the smallest room with the largest heater in Oxford. I moved into a room which was tiny by comparison with anything I'd stayed in whatchamacallit, in University College. And it had two electric heaters. My landlord was an electrician's helper. He had a wife and one child, and I would leave my room and close the door and leave the heater on, so that when I came back, I would have a warm room. Invariably, my landlord would go into my room and turn off my heater. Because he was paying for the heat. I was giving him, you know, rent. Yeah. Sorry about that. I told you that would happen. Never mind. Oh, the reason, the only reason I mentioned the business with the Congress on the Gospels is because of the room, number one. Number two, Jean Danielou was giving a lecture at the end of the Conference on the Gospels. He was a famous Roman Catholic scholar. And I was late for this lecture. And so the lecture was given in the examination rooms and was on the second story. I remember running up the steps to go in, and I dashed into the room, and his arm came out and caught me. And when I turned around to see who this was, it was the Archbishop of Canterbury. I recognized him because I had watched the coronation of Queen Elizabeth before I left to go to him. And there he was talking to who? F.L. Cross, my tutor. I have in my file somewhere a photograph which was taken and sent to me of the back of my head and the face of F.L. Cross and the Archbishop of Canterbury. Because the photographer, of course, was standing behind me because he was taking pictures of important people. Anyway, I had a good time at Oxford. For there are three vacation times at Oxford. For two of them, I did the continental tour. I went to, you know, France and to Spain and to Germany and Italy. So I checked out the continent. Those two. And of course, the third, I came home. That was the long, what they call the long vac, which is the summer vacation. You were supposed to study during those breaks. I didn't study during those breaks. I wasn't taking a degree. So anyway, after that, I went to Virginia Seminary in Alexandria, Virginia for 3 years and graduated from that institution and was ordained to the diaconate. And then after 9 months, actually, I was ordained to the priesthood, and I began to work.
So then what led you to come back to Dartmouth and then end up being?
As the dean of the Tucker Foundation?
Yes.
Well, let's see. I was... when was it? I got a telephone call while I was the rector of St. Cyprian's in Roxbury, Massachusetts. I got a telephone call from Don Kreider, who was a vice president and in charge of student affairs. He called me up and he said, Warner, how would you like to be the dean of the Tucker Foundation? And I said, Professor Kreider, I don't know what the Tucker Foundation is. And he said, well, if you will invite me by your house, we will make an appointment and I will come and I will tell you what the Tucker Foundation is. So I said, fine. Yeah. And so he sat in my kitchen with me. I'll never forget this. He said, Warner, the Tucker Foundation is whatever the dean of the Tucker Foundation says it is. There is a saying that if you hear that something is too good to be true, it probably is. Well, that's not quite what this turned out to be, at least to begin with. My career at Dartmouth College falls into two parts. I was hired by John Kemeny when he was president. I was forced out by David McLaughlin, who succeeded John Kemeny. David McLaughlin was president of Dartmouth College after John Kemeny. John Kemeny and I got along fine. David McLaughlin and I did not get along at all. And so I left.
Yeah.
I was at Dartmouth for 9 years. I think I overlapped with McLaughlin for, I think, only two, maybe three. I can't remember. But John Kemeny understood the Tucker Foundation, or at least he understood what the dean of the Tucker Foundation said the Tucker Foundation was. David McLaughlin did not. To be straightforward and simple about it. I don't know why Don Kreider called me. I never found out why I was chosen for this job. I was the fourth dean of the Tucker Foundation. First dean of the Tucker Foundation had taught me in the religion department. I can't call his name at the moment, but we got along fine as when I was a student, and we got along even better when I was dean of the Tucker Foundation, because he was still there.
Yeah.
And he was on the board of the Tucker Foundation. Unsworth was the next dean, and then Doc Dye was my immediate predecessor. When I came to, well, I've answered your question. You asked me how I came to be the dean.
What was it that made your relationship to Kemeny so different than your relationship to McLaughlin?
Well, Kemeny and I, well, the Tucker Foundation, when I came there, was running a number of placements for students off campus.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to raise funds because the college didn't pay for those, most of those. I had to raise funds for those placements and so forth.
Placements for what? Placements for housing, was that?
No. This was, students were sent to what Doc Dye called the Other America. He's the one really who established these fellowships.
Okay.
And tutorials and so forth. Dartmouth students were sent to the inner city to learn about the inner city, because most of them were suburbanites.
Yeah.
Or were assumed to be. And didn't know anything about what he called the Other America. What he's talking about is Black people and Native Americans, okay? Because we did have a Native American placement in, I think it was Wyoming, Montana. And we had placements in Jersey City and various other areas. And some of them Dartmouth students tutored students and so forth. You know, they did the kinds of things they could do, you know. When I came, my first concern was to increase the impact of the Tucker Foundation on campus. Because when I came, the world had changed somewhat from when Doc Dye was there. And students were more focused on campus and less focused on the world outside campus. I invented broadsides. There was no regular chapel. I don't imagine that there is now a regular chapel at Dartmouth College. At Harvard, when I was the Associate Episcopal Chaplain at Harvard, Harvard had a regular chapel service, and students and faculty came to it. Same was true of Yale. I think, well, I'll stop there, because that's all I can think of anymore. So I tried a chapel service a couple of times, as a matter of fact, didn't take, you know, people turned out to begin with, and then it just sort of dribbled away. But I, one of the things that I had begun doing prior to going to Dartmouth was collecting Tatler, the Spectator, and the Guardian. These were 18th century English periodicals. They were newspapers before newspapers. They consisted of an essay and some ads. And they were sold for a halfpenny or so during the reign of Queen Anne. Addison and Steele were the authors of those three periodicals. I collected them. I collected the originals, and I've still got the critical reprints, you know, with comments by scholars, so forth. I told my son recently, when I die, you should take those books and sell them to use bookstores. The rest of my library, which covers the walls of this room, is to go to the local branch, the public library. But those should be sold, and then they can divvy up the money. Anyway, because those were harder to come by than the original sheets of the Spectator, the Tatler, and the Guardian, actually. Anyway, I had a brilliant idea one day. I thought it was brilliant. and that was to, why didn't I just, you know, if I wanted to have some impact on the campus, write an essay like the essays in the Tatler, Spectator, and Guardian, and send them to all the students and all the faculty. One member of the faculty at the end of my tenure referred to them as my encyclicals. You know, the Pope writes encyclicals and then. Of the essays which I wrote, the one on homosexuality was the one that made the most impact on campus. And I think whenever anybody who remembers them, I have no idea how many there are in the world who do remember them, that's the one they remember.
Yeah.
People stop me on the street to thank me for writing that. I legitimized the discussion of homosexuality on Dartmouth's campus because there had been no discussion before. My the first dean of the Tucker Foundation. Berthel, that's what his name was. Berthel. He was in the religion department. He was the first dean. Before I wrote the one on homosexuality, I spoke to him and asked him, well, I'm sorry. I need to go back further. One of the things I'm still answering your, I haven't forgotten what your question was, which was, why did I get along with Kemeny and not get along with McLaughlin? At one point, the dean of students asked me if I would chair a committee on equal opportunity. The committee was supposed to determine the impact of Dartmouth on Black students. That was, that's why it was called equal opportunity. Equal was the operative phrase. Well, and so at one point we held a hearing in Dartmouth Hall in, 105? Is that right? 105 Dartmouth Hall. It's the middle room in Dartmouth Hall.
They just reconstructed it, so I haven't been inside since my freshman year.
Really? Oh.
I don't know the building number, the room numbers anymore.
That's interesting. I haven't been back to Dartmouth since, I did go back maybe a couple years after I was the dean. Jim Breeden, who succeeded me, invited me back because he invited all the deans that were living back. All right. Anyway, after that hearing in, I think it's one of the, it's the middle room right underneath the spire, on Dartmouth Hall. Anyway, I think that's where the great issues were, but you probably don't have those anymore either. No, you don't have them because I didn't have them when I was there as dean. Anyway, a student came up to me and said, since this is a committee on equal opportunity, I think I would like to talk to you about the gay students on campus. Well, this was a surprise to me because he was the first person to ever mention it. And I had been at Dartmouth, I guess, about 2 or 3 years at that point. So I met with him and a couple of other gay students. And I suggested to them that they wanted to form an organization. Yeah. And so I said, go to Costco. And see if they will fund you. Well, he didn't think they would, and they didn't. So I said, all right, then we'll fund you. And so the foundation did. We funded them. And it was a big to-do about that for a little while. People made nasty comments about bring your lube and one thing and another. Anyway, so then I had a conversation with Berthel, and Berthel said, I asked him, if anybody had ever, talked to him about it. And he said he had considered doing something about this, but that, how do I say this? Well, there were reasons why the gay students that he knew did not want to have an organization on campus. Well, obviously things had changed because now I was being approached by some gay students who did want an organization, and they set up the organization.
Do you happen to know what year this is?
What year it was that I wrote
that far into your tenure, at least?
Unfortunately, I have sent my copies of the homosexual broadside to Virginia Seminary with all my papers. And I don't remember off the top of my head, tell you the truth.
I know that the Special Collections Library has a copy of the broadside. So is this happening at the same? Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, then you know.
What time is that? Or is this like a year? So this is like the same year that you published the broadside?
Oh, yeah. It would have been about the same year. Yeah. Well, no, the student would probably have come to me the year before.
Got it.
I wrote the broadside because I had to do some research. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so after my conversation with Bertho, I decided I would do the broadside. I did. And like I said, it had the kind of impact that I said it had. Third thing, I tell people, I was hired as the dean of the Tucker Foundation. The chaplaincy was in my gift. So I named myself the chaplain. And I hired two people to do the work of the chaplaincy. So I was the dean and chaplain at Dartmouth College, dean of the Tucker Foundation, chaplain at Dartmouth College. One of the things that the chaplain was responsible for doing was what the foundation was supposed to do was to be concerned with the moral and spiritual life and influence of the college, okay? John Kemeny understood that. John Kemeny's position with respect to college business was that issues could be debated on campus, fine. But once the Board of Trustees made a decision about any issue, the administration was supposed to back the trustees' position, except for the chaplain and dean of the Tucker Foundation. Because since my bailiwick was the moral and spiritual work of the college, if the trustees made a decision that I did not think was morally advantageous for the college, I could take exception to it after they set the policy. Well, when I came to Dartmouth, Dartmouth had, I think, 3,000 students who were males. John Kemeny introduced women to the college, which means they added 1,000 women. Now, nobody really, I don't think, ever thought anything could stay like that. 3,000 men, 1,000 women. That meant when women applied for the college, they applied for one of 1,000 positions. Well, I mean, you know, I'm putting the whole thing together. I'm not, obviously, that's not the way it works. They applied for 1/4 of the freshman class is really what it is. Well, of course, the male students didn't like it any better than the female students did. Because the ratio was screwed. All right. Several students came to me as the dean of the Tucker Foundation, and they said, don't you think this is ridiculous? This is not the way the college should operate. I was told when I came to Dartmouth that the reason there were 3,000 males and 1,000 women, and that that was the way it was going to stay, was because you had to have 3,000 men in order to field a winning football team. That's what they told me. That's really what they told me. Manifestly, that was silly. You know, you're going to put a football team, you're going to put, you know, fielding a football team above, you know, equalizing the ratio of men and women in the college. Not going to work. So students began coming to me saying, you know, look at this. This is crazy, you know. And I explained to them, you know, that the trust at that point, the trustees, you know, had laid down the law, you know, about this. And so everybody in administration was supposed to back up the trustees, except me. So students wanted to hold demonstrations. We did. One of the demonstrations, well, let me back up for a moment. Dean Kemeny had a thing called the PAC. It was made up of all the vice presidents and deans in the college. And it advised him about various things. Well, we never really had a discussion about coeducation in the PAC that I recall. But I did express myself with respect to the ratio in that group. At one point, because students fielded demonstrations, I was in the demonstration outside the office of John Kemeny. John Kemeny looked out and he saw me, you know, among the students. And he said, oh, what are you doing here, Warner? And I said, I'm demonstrating with the students. And he said, oh. And we had a conversation subsequently, as you may imagine. And he said he didn't remember my letting him know that I didn't think much of this ratio. I said, well, I did. And even if you don't remember me saying it before, you now know that that is my position and my opinion. And John Kemeny said, I understand. And that is your right, because the charge of the Tucker Foundation is to be concerned with something different from what the trustees are dealing with. Okay, fine. This is what McLaughlin did not believe or understand. Okay. This is why I ended up crossing swords with McLaughlin. He thought that the business of the president was to determine what the Tucker Foundation should do. And he didn't like the idea of the dean of the Tucker Foundation taking positions with respect to moral questions. At one point, he even wrote me a memo saying that what the dean should do is what the faculty does. Now, the dean was not a member of the faculty. I'm the chaplain of the college. That's one reason I took that office of chaplain. So it would be clear, you know, that, I mean, clergy take positions with respect to moral and social issues. Yeah. Faculty, well, let's take the philosophy faculty, for instance, you know. The philosophy faculty teaches the philosophies of various people, Nietzsche, Hegel, Mills, and so forth, you know? The clergy don't do that. Our business is not educating people with respect to the realm of ethics. Our business is to take positions as Christians with respect to moral issues. That's what I did. McLaughlin never understood that. He never understood that. Or he professed not to understand it if he did. Okay? John Kemeny understood it, which is why Jan Kemeny did not force me out. John Kemeny left the presidency, and he left me there. It was McLaughlin who forced me out because he did not agree with what I did. So I left because, you know, I had a small boat with a big pond. And McLaughlin's boat was a lot bigger. He could make waves. He cut my budget astronomically. I came back from a sabbatical. And the Tucker Foundation, which had a smaller budget, was being cut by much more than any other section of the college. Mm-hmm. I hit the ceiling. They brought it down. But then they wanted to rework the foundation. And it was just one thing after another. It was obvious, perfectly obvious to everybody, not just to me. But to everybody on campus, that the president didn't want the dean of the Tucker Foundation to continue. Yeah. And so I looked around. I was actually at Dartmouth longer than I expected to be. I'm really an urbanite. Mm. You asked me earlier how I adjusted to being at Dartmouth. I adjusted fine because it was 4 years, you know. And I mean, I went back home, you know, for the summer and so forth. But I'm really an urbanite. I'm not a country boy. I was raised in central Baltimore. I like cities. I live in Los Angeles, second largest city in the country.
Yeah.
People ask me how I adjusted to Los Angeles after leaving New Hampshire, because I came directly here. I told them I got here in July at the height of the smog season. Mm. I stepped outside my car and looked around and said, what took me so long?
Yeah.
That was how I adjusted to Los Angeles. Anyway, I expected to be at Dartmouth for at least 5 years because your pension, the Episcopal Church has a pension system for its clergy. When I started to work for Dartmouth College, I was no longer working for the Episcopal Church. I had been working for the Episcopal Church up until that time, and I went back to working for the Episcopal Church after I left Dartmouth. When I got to Dartmouth, my pension, I got a letter from the Episcopal Church Pension Fund telling me they had frozen my pension. That was a surprise. I hadn't even thought about it. But Dartmouth paid my pension into the TIAA CREF. But my pension would not vest in me until after 5 years. Yeah. I really was pretty well committed to being at Dartmouth for 5 years. Well, you know, I was at Dartmouth for 5 years. John Kemeny was still here. See, everything went along fine as far as I was concerned, you know. When McLaughlin became president, I couldn't have been with McLaughlin more than 2 years, I think. Oh, no, seven, eight, nine. No, 3 years, because I took a sabbatical. Mm-hmm. And then there were 2 years, because I was at Dartmouth for 9 years all too. So anyway, that's... and so, you know, I really had stayed longer than I anticipated staying. I was the longest serving dean at the Tucker Foundation when I left. I don't know about now, but then, you know, I enjoyed that too. I enjoyed being the dean of the Tucker Foundation. I had a great time. Even the fight with McLaughlin was illuminating.
What was the difference between working at Dartmouth and Harvard? I know you were in different positions of like.
Oh yeah, well, I was employed by Dartmouth. I was not employed by Harvard. I was employed by the Episcopal Church at Harvard. The Rhinelander Foundation was the name of the organization that hired me. I was not hired by Dartmouth. I was not a corporation appointment. That's all the difference in the world. There's no comparison, really no comparison. I say that at Harvard, it was like I was a fly trying to get the attention of an elephant. At Dartmouth, I was a part of the college.
Yeah.
You know, my office was the whole first floor of what is now College Center. Oh, it was then called College Hall. I remember one of the officers of the Alumni Center coming into the foundation at College Hall. And he said, "My God, Warner, the Tucker Foundation runs from the green to the river." Oh, but that was an overstatement.
Yeah.
But we did occupy the entirety of the first floor.
Wow.
of College Hall. You know? My children used to walk through those, you know, the a College Center, those big window doors, mm-hmm. on the open off the portico, you know. Yeah. They used to come in and out of those things, you know. When they wanted to avoid dealing with anybody else in the foundation. My office was right there. You know? I was in administration row, you know. Not at Harvard. No comparison at all. At Harvard, I was working for the Episcopal Church. What we had to do was to figure out ways to get the attention of the students at Harvard.
Got it.
At Dartmouth, I had to figure out some of that too. But it was all the difference in the world. I was appointed by the president. I met the president of Harvard, but he did not appoint me.
Yeah.
He did not pay me, you know. He didn't have to even speak to me. Yeah. It was all the difference in the world, no. Mm-hmm. At Harvard, I was an Episcopal priest. At Dartmouth, I was the dean of the Tucker Foundation and the chaplain of the college.
How did you perceive the, like, cultures on campus being different, though, like, with your relations?
Oh, my. Oh, there's no comparison.
Yeah.
No comparison. It's the difference between Cambridge and Oxford. If you know Cambridge and Oxford, Oxford is a medieval school. Mm-hmm. It has, every college has walls. The lawns are inside the walls. There are city streets outside, busy streets outside, you know. Oxford is famous for making cars. Cambridge is a Renaissance school. The colleges sit in the lawns. Yeah. The lawns are outside the college. Dartmouth, the lawns are outside the college, like Cambridge. Harvard, the lawns are inside the schools, like Oxford. Harvard is older than Dartmouth. Oxford is older than Cambridge. That's easy. That's easy. Harvard is academic with a big A. Dartmouth is a college.
How did they, I guess not even less so much the difference, but because you said you were chair of the Committee on Equal Opportunity.
Yes.
What was that experience like? And also considering the fact that you've been a student and then in two different administrations, how do you perceive the like ebbs and flows of Dartmouth's like hopes for diversity and like making education accessible across the board? It's a big question.
There were a lot more Black students on campus when I came here as the dean. Mm-hmm. Than there were when I was an undergraduate. So that was progress, quote unquote. It was also true that the faculty, there were many more Black people on the faculty than I don't remember there being anybody on the faculty when I was an undergraduate here. There certainly was nobody that I studied under.
Yeah.
Who was Black on the faculty. As a matter of fact, I'm pretty well confident there were no Black people on the faculty here then. There are a whole lot more Black people on the faculty when I was an undergraduate. I have no idea what the situation looks like now. But there were also problems that there weren't when I was an undergraduate. It is always the case, from my examination of the world I live in, and particularly the country I live in, that once you get a critical number of Black people, you have problems you never had when you only had a few. A few Black people disappear. A critical mass has to be dealt with. I remember the Black tables when I was the Dean of the Tucker Foundation. Invariably, somebody, usually an alumnus or a parent, or sometimes a student, would say things like, why is it that the Black students sit together in Thayer Hall? You still sit in Thayer Hall, don't you?
The engineering.
Huh?
Thayer is the engineering school now.
Oh, is it? No, there always was a Thayer Engineering School. Mm-hmm. What's the refectory called?
The what?
The refectory, where you eat.
Oh, it's dining hall. Class of 53 Commons.
Class of 53 Commons. Okay, everything has changed then. Yeah. That used to be Thayer Hall. There was always the Thayer Engineering School. Mm-hmm. When I was an undergraduate, there was the Thayer Engineering School. Well, okay, then, in the dining hall, okay, people would say to me, why did Black students all sit together? I would say, that's not any mystery. Look, at that point in time, you know, they grew up in Black communities. Still, most people, Black community, most Black people live in Black communities. For reasons which I won't go into at the moment. They've come to a predominantly white school. They were still in decided minority when I was the dean at the Tucker Foundation. They get assigned to white students in their rooms. They go to classes, most of which were then still taught by white people. There were many more Black people than before I came, but they still were a minority again. They're in a white world. Make it quick. You know, and so they have to spend half their time explaining themselves to other people. At some point, they want to be with people they don't have to explain themselves to. That's why there are Black tables. But if you look carefully in the dining room, not all Black students are sitting at Black tables. Some of them have integrated white tables, which you don't think about. White people think if you walk into a room and there are Black tables and white tables, the odd thing are the Black tables, because they've always been surrounded by white people. Okay? I tell people there was a movie called The Little Bighorn, I think it was called. Little Bighorn. And it was about a white boy who was kidnapped, really, by some Indians. I don't know if you're familiar with this movie or not. It was a while back. I'm trying to think of who this is, short guy again, who was the star of the movie. His name will come to me. Anyway, this white boy is raised as an Indian in this movie. And at one point, an old Indian, he and an old Indian go off because the old Indian is going off to die, okay? And he's talking about the situation of the Indians. Now, early on, we are given to understand that the word Sioux, which is the name of this Indian group, means human beings, just human beings. So at one point, the man says, the Great Spirit, he's bewailing the fact that the Indians are being displaced, really. And he says, it seems like the Great Spirits have made an unlimited number of white people and only a few human beings. Think about that. For the Indian, the human beings are the Indians. It's the white people who are odd. The same thing happens with white people and Black people. You know? That's why the white people walk into a white school, see Black tables, and say, why are they there? The human beings are sitting all around. These Black people are something different. And why are they segregating themselves? They are not. Or if they are, I guess you could say that they are. But they are because they're in a white world. And they've got to take some time. They've got to go to classes with white people. They've got to discuss things with white people. They've got to go to stores with white people. They're surrounded by white people. At some point, it's nice to be able to talk to people, to make jokes that they will understand, that they don't have to be, they don't have to be interpreted, you know, to use words that mean something to them and not to the white people and all the rest of it. So, but, you know, I can't tell you how many times people have asked me, why are the black people, why are the black people segregating themselves? You know? And as I said, the movie was the clue to me, you know. The Great Spirit has made an unlimited number of white people and only a limited number of human beings. He thinks there's a difference between these two groups too, you know. Yeah. But the difference is just the opposite of what white people would have thought, you know, about the Indians. Anyway.
Did you perceive, was there a difference between Kemeny and McLaughlin specifically?
Did I what? Perceive?
Was there like a difference in like these conversations about like black students when it was Kemeny's presidency versus?
Oh, I don't know. I never had a conversation with McLaughlin about black students.
Mm-hmm. Was that like a?
No, at my problem with McLaughlin was that he was a poor administrator. He forced out not just myself. He forced out several other people by second guessing them. Mm. He had the reputation that, part of it is, let me back up for a moment. I remember a member of the faculty saying, when Kemeny was president, that most members of the faculty think Kemeny is smarter than they are. And he probably is. That's what the member of the faculty said.
Yeah.
Well, I think McLaughlin, I guess I shouldn't say it that way. No, McLaughlin had the reputation of being, he had the reputation of being an intellectual lightweight, okay? And his problem was he succeeded Kemeny, who had the opposite reputation. I really think that's part of it. They used to say that if three people go in to see McLaughlin, and each one of them persuades him of their perspective, the last person to see him is the one who will get his perspective implemented.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Also, McLaughlin would second guess his own officers. Now, if you were the dean of students and somebody comes to you with an issue, you know, to adjudicate between students, so forth. And you make the decision. You're the dean of students. That's your job.
Yeah.
And then the parent of that student, who's an alumnus, goes to see the president and wants a different judgment. And the president makes a different judgment, you're not going to keep that dean of students very long.
Yeah.
Because it's his job. It's not the president's job. He doesn't want to be second-guessed. You know, you don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, at the most, you might call the dean of students in and say, well, do you really think that's what you should have done. And if the dean of students says yes, you say, okay. But you certainly don't unilaterally reverse him, you know? Because then nobody, what? Why don't we go to the dean of students? Let's go to the president. And the next thing you know, the dean of students is gone. He's found himself a job where they want him to do what he's supposed to do. Yeah. Well, so those were the kinds of problems that I saw with the president, and I pointed them out to him, which of course did not make me popular, but it didn't matter at that point. Anyway. I don't get sued for saying that.
To go quickly back to the committee on
you don't disability. Have to put that in the review. Hmm? I said you don't have to put that in the interview.
But to the part of the chair being the chair and committee of equal opportunity, what were the goals of that like committee? I mean,
some students, Black students, had put out a document. Mm-hmm. I've forgotten now what it was called, but they put out a document with registered complaints about what the college needed to do with respect to Black students and so forth. And then the college decided, you know, to set up this committee. At this point, I don't recall what the specific determinations of the committee were. But they weren't too far from the suggestions made by the Black students initially. But it was wanted to have a committee to look into the business, to take testimony. That's really what we did, you know, to get feedback from individual students and so forth, Black students mostly, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So,
do you feel
it was not earth shaking, I don't think. Yeah. Unfortunately.
Do you remember your role in the committee besides chairing it? Or like what did that entail?
Oh, I just set up meetings with students. And like I said, we ended with the hearing. I think that was the end. I can't remember. Yeah, I'm sure it was.
Cool. Those are my specific questions. But if there's anything else that you'd want to share about your time as a student or your time as dean?
No, I don't think so.
Cool.
I think we've pretty well covered things.
Good breath. And I ask one final thing is where you are now in LA. What is your life like now? And I know is there a medical center named after you as well in your community?
Oh, yeah. excuse me. Oh, you're well informed.
Did some research.
When I came to St. John's, mm-hmm. in the 80s, there was a thing called St. John's Well Child Center. Well, let me back up for a moment. The parish was known for being active in the community. There was a thing called St. John's Well Child Center. It met in two rooms in the parish hall. It was medical. It was called the Well Child Center because all it dealt with was inoculations, physicals, things like that. But things which the people in the neighborhood, which when it was set up were black. By the time I got here, the people were Latinos. But it still did the same work. It recruited doctors who volunteered their services. It had equipment which was donated and so forth. It was somebody called it at one point a hole in the wall operation. But for people who didn't have medical insurance and so forth, it was helpful. It was useful. Well, it went along. I maintained it. And it went along for a while. We had our ups and downs. We lost the insurance for a while, and the doctor's insurance, you know. And, of course, doctors don't work without insurance. You're crazy to work without insurance as a doctor. So we had to shut it down for a week or two until we managed to get a new insurer, all kinds of odd, peculiar, but happy things happen. But I won't need to go into. Anyway, we hired a fellow by the name of Jim Monja. And Jim Monja, I always say, had the Midas touch. He could make anything turn to gold. It's amazing what you can do with money. The two rooms in the parish hall of St. John's Church has expanded into, last I heard, I don't want to sell him short, 14 different clinics, full clinics in the Los Angeles city. In the Los Angeles area, because some of them are in cities. You know, Los Angeles is a perforated city.
Yeah.
It has cities within its borders.
Yeah.
And it's a multi-million-dollar operation. Well, since I was the rector of the church, when we appointed Jim Monja, after naming several other clinics after various people for reasons best known to Jim Monja. Oh, I'm sorry. It's also been obviously incorporated, and it is distinct from the church at this point.
Yeah.
Been distinct from the church for some time. It's still called St. John's Well Child and Family Clinic. It's called now, I think. Yeah, actually, I think they changed the name again, but I've forgotten what that is now. But anyway, Jim called me up one day and said they wanted to name a clinic after me. They're naming the clinic, which happens to be closest to the parish. And so I went to the naming ceremony, I guess you call it, with several politicians and so forth. And yeah, they named the clinic after me.
Thanks.
The church also, in the Reagan era, got money from HUD. There was a project in HUD at that time to build housing for the homeless, mentally ill. And so there is another project down Figueroa. The church is on the corner of Figueroa and Adams, several blocks down Figueroa. Which houses, I think it's 20 or 25 homeless people. And we set that using HUD money. We set that up while I was the rector also. So that's named after a previous rector of St. John's. They wanted to name it after me, but I was said, no, you don't name things after people who were the ones who pushed for the thing in the first place. So, and it wasn't with my money. At Dartmouth, you name things for the people who give the money for it, like the College Center. You see that? I wasn't given any money, so. But anyway, we did do that, yeah. So, and then we did a number of other community things. But those are the two structural things that we did.
Cool. And I just remembered a question that I meant to ask earlier, so it's a little bit of a bounce back. But I saw in an article that you mentioned that was about you and working with Harvard, that you had mentioned that you left Harvard partially because you want the institution didn't seem like it was going to change. Do you feel that Dartmouth as an institution is one that is willing to change? Or is that how you
feel? I didn't think.
Was that not you?
That Harvard was what
was not willing to change or not?
Oh, I think all these schools change constantly.
Yeah.
No, I don't think I said that. If I did, I shouldn't have.
It was.
I mean, and Dartmouth clearly has changed. I mean, I don't know the names of any of the buildings the only reason I know that College Hall is College Center is because I got this calendar in the mail the other day. I didn't see much change at Harvard, but I certainly, I was only there for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I was at Dartmouth for 9.
Yeah.
Dartmouth did change while I was there. I mean, we got rid of the crazy, male, female, business. I'm sure Harvard changes. It doesn't look like it changes, but I'm sure it does. It has to, every place has to. Matter of fact, Harvard, is in court right now fighting over affirmative action.
Mm-hmm.
I have my opinions about that too, but we won't go into that because that's
it's too bad. I think
the Dartmouth College, that's right.
I think we're approaching time probably.
Sure. Yes.
But would have loved to hear more about your thoughts on that. But thank you so much.
Well, let me ask you a question then. Yeah. Rauner, what is it? Rauner Library?
Yes.
What is that? Because that wasn't there when I was there either.
So it's currently housed, or I'm going to stop the recording because I can just.
Okay, fine. Sure. You can stop recording. Yeah.